Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Ciarán Mulqueen of Crazy House Prices fame. And just before I get to Ciarán and bring him in and we go through what is going on with our housing crisis, I just wanted to start by saying that I've been really overwhelmed by the response in the last 2 months to the work that I've been doing on the investor funds and the housing crisis, and people sending me their stories. And those stories are really just, you know, they're horrific, they're sad. And I will keep sharing them because I know a lot of you and people who are sending them to me are actually getting a sense of support and solidarity from reading other people's situation, because there is a real need to challenge the isolation that is within this housing crisis. And also, as well, there's been a lovely response to the recent Reboot Republic Housing Shock podcast that we've done, particularly the episodes with Mick Byrne on renters, Louisa Santoro from Mendicity on homelessness, and Frank O'Connor and Jude Cherry from Anish on dereliction. So you can listen back to those as well. And a very special thank you to all of you who are patrons, who are supporting us with what you can each month, keeping the lights on and keeping our production team of one, Tony Groves, of Tortoise Shack going and keeping the show on the road. So if you can, please go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and you will get the episodes first before anyone else, and you'll keep this show on the road, which really is trying to change things and bring the voices of change to the fore and to you. And just a word on the share your story that I've been highlighting and encouraging people to do. This is really important. I think it's central to the way we can build a public movement that can make a change in housing. So if you want to share your story, go to hashtag #EndHousingCrisis on Twitter. You can send them to me at Rory Hearn on Twitter or on Instagram as well. And I'll post them anonymously for you. And I just wanted to read two stories that were sent to me this week. The first was a story which was sent, and it was in response to the Blind Boy podcast, which I was on, which also had an incredible response to. And the person just said, "Hi, Roy, hope you're well. Just listened to the Blind Boy podcast amongst loads of stuff you've been involved in recently. I just wanted to add something. You talked about Finland a bit, and I'd like to say a couple of things. I used to live there with my ex-partner for a long period. And from living in various countries abroad, I can tell you the one thing they have that we don't, the absolute crucial fundamental thing you didn't mention, I feel, is the lack of greed. They just don't have it in their makeup. And if you have genuine empathy for your compatriots and brothers and sisters, all your decisions while you're in power will be dictated by this. But when I look at the people in power in this country, it sickens me that the greed is so obvious, but we as a nation stand by and take it. It sickens and saddens me. Blind Boy talks about it being complex, and obviously there are many mechanisms in play. But personally, I feel it's the nature of the policymakers that needs to change. Can you change people's nature? Probably not. Can you vote them out? Absolutely. There has to be massive changes in the Dáil before anything can change in our country. I'm 37. I'm a fully employed renter who's struggling to make ends meet. I've just had my second child after rent and bills, and I'm almost broke. And I just felt after listening to the show, I wanted to have a rant and let you know I admire what you're doing." And there's been many, many stories like that sent. And I think it is important that people do speak out. And also, obviously, there's the petition, which I set up with Uplift, which you can go over to uplift.ie to sign. It has 34,000 signatures. We want to push it higher. See, could we get to 50,000? Could we get to 100,000? And that petition about stopping the investor funds for a right to housing, for building public and affordable homes, and for protection for renters. Just a couple of stories this week on the housing crisis that I wanted to bring to you before I go to Ciarán. We see a Focus Ireland research showed that over 38,000 adults were made homeless since 2014, which I looked up a couple of the cities in Dublin, in Ireland, to see which one that population was closest to. And it turns out that that's equivalent to the entire adult population of Waterford City being made homeless, and that incredible level of human suffering caused by housing policy and not individual issues. Of course, that housing policy prioritizing investors, the market, the landlord, and banks. We also had the highlighting again this week of the Ombudsman for Children, the issue of traveller accommodation, substandard conditions, the state violating travellers' human rights, and been highlighted again. Example of a site in St. Margaret's in Ballymun, just incredibly, you know, disgraceful conditions the state has left travellers in. We also had highlighted by Fierce, social worker on Twitter, a massive build-to-rent apartment development in Galway, which is, of course, going to be rented on affordable rents and unavailable to buy. But I did a bit of research into it and found that the Irish State Fund, the Irish State Investment Fund, which is your fund, is actually funding this development. And that the funder behind it is called Quadrant Estate Real Estate Fund. And on the Irish Strategic Investment Fund website, you can see they're funding them and other build-to-rent investors. As the Rolling Stone called them, the vampire squids, and the vampire squids of Generation Rent. And Deborah Reynolds, who's been on this podcast, highlighted that children are living in B&Bs, hotels near this, and the site would be ideal for a community of social and affordable homes instead of this. Homeless children don't need this. And finally, we've seen house prices rise again this week. And of course, we need to ask, why has the government not implemented what I've called on, which is an emergency budget that should be done based on the ESRI recommendation that they can borrow 4 to 7 billion to fast track building of affordable homes on public land? Why have they not done that? Because they aren't serious about the crisis and they don't actually want affordable housing. Kieran Mulqueen, after that of crazy house prices, how are you?
I'm great, Rory. Thanks for having me on.
Good, good, good. Listen, you've been doing great work for a number of years, highlighting, as it is the name, crazy house prices. Hmm. Do you want to explain a little bit about what you've been doing?
I suppose it started off as a joke, to be honest, because we've been looking for a house for a couple of years now. Myself and my wife were both teachers, so... it just started off as a joke because we live in Portobello in my in-law's house, and obviously the house prices around here are outrageous and throughout all of Dublin 8. So I kind of, you know, you're looking at the houses nearby and it's just looking at them thinking this is madness. And looking back now, they're very cheap then compared to this year. As the
when did you start?
Probably 2019. The prices were really bad then. So I just started doing kind of comparisons between what you can buy in Dublin, what you can buy down the country. As a joke, obviously, I understand that you pay a premium to live in a city compared to living in rural Ireland and all of that. So you still get the odd few people being like, well, this isn't really a good comparison. And I'm like, you must be new here. It's all a joke. Calm down. But
Connor Skeen was probably looking for your help, was he? You're showing the choice that people are making. The right choice. You can buy like in Kerry or, you know, somewhere like that for, you know, next to nothing.
Yeah, yeah. And then as I learned kind of throughout the buying process, different things, kind of what you need to have an order and mortgages and all that, I just started kind of just throwing up a few helpful infographics on the page with trying to give the information in kind of bite-sized chunks. Being a teacher, I suppose that's part of my job, is trying to relay information in a more understandable way. So that kind of helped as well, kick off the page. And it's just kind of grown really, really quickly from there. And it's gotten massive. And I suppose the page has kind of taken a bit of a direction now where I'm trying to help as much as possible. And as you said, like just kind of exposing some different things that's going on in the market that I don't feel is very good practice. And then you've been doing huge work over the last few years as well. Well, over the last kind of, I don't know, 12 years or 13 years, but I've been just sharing your stuff for the last couple of years. And Killian Woods as well is doing phenomenal work, the journalist. So I don't know whether it's because it's the circles that I'm seeing or the accounts I'm following and my algorithm, but all I seem to see is kind of activist stuff and what we can do, and not just giving out like I do on my page, but also offering solutions like that you do in your book as well. So it's kind of grown from there, and it's grown every day. And you spoke there about getting stories in. I probably get about 50 in a day. People wanting to share their story. This is what they're dealing with. This is basically saying, look, Kieran, this is, we've been renting for years, or we've been trying to buy, we're living in our parents, we've two kids. Like a lot of the same stories that you've heard, and behind each story is a family and relatives and everything else involved. So it's not just one person sharing their story, but there's there's a whole host of people around them as well. So I just think people are fed up at this point.
Kieran, where do you think, you know, people are asking me, you know, why is it suddenly exploded now? You know, like, what was it with the, you know, the investor fund buying the estate in Maynooth, or, you know, why now?
I think in the run up to the last general election, I think it was everywhere then also, but maybe there wasn't. I think social media has helped a lot. Like accounts like mine that have since then have grown to like about 45,000 followers now. So I think as accounts that are speaking out against issues have grown as well. But then with COVID, it was all put on the back burner, and everything, all the news was dominated by COVID. And kind of once there was light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to vaccines and all of that, I think people were able to kind of refocus their anger back onto what has always been a huge issue in every election is housing. So people are just, I think, yeah, as you said, that investor fund was probably the straw that broke the back, and people just got furious. And I suppose with the work that we're putting in, yourself and myself and other people that are putting so much time and effort in, is maybe just getting that out to more people that just didn't see it or didn't know, because a lot of these stories can get buried, and if it doesn't go viral, you won't see it. So I've just been lucky, I suppose, with the amount of stuff that I'm sharing, other people are sharing it, and it's getting a good bit bigger, and it's getting more eyes on it. And like, I get people sending me messages all the time, people in their 50s, in their 60s, going, "Jesus, I never realized things were this bad." And that's what we need. You know, we need that generation who are cushioned from all of this to really think, okay, well, like, it doesn't impact me, but it's going to impact my grandkids. But they're not going to be able to find anywhere to live, and they're going to have to emigrate like we did 10 years ago. So I really think that's important, that those that aren't really impacted by house prices or by rental crisis can see that, you know, this is going to impact future generations of my family or my relatives or whatever. And I think that's quite important.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you on that. And I feel that's the thing that's changing in the last kind of couple of months, is that kind of sense that this was something that, you know, was just restricted to, you know, certain groups even, that this wasn't something that was affecting, you know, a whole generation. And also, you know, the idea, you know, in the UK, it's talked about a lot. You know, you've millennials and youngers blamed for, you know, spending all their money on avocado toast, and, you know, that blaming of them rather than an older generation saying that, you know, that, oh, this is their fault for being feckless, for not saving enough, for, you know, taking poor decisions on their jobs. Whereas, thankfully, we haven't seen that here. We haven't seen it yet. But I don't think I think it's actually going the other way. And I think in part, you're right, that the work that we've been doing in highlighting the policy causes of this, you know, that it's not individuals' fault. And I think people have, you know, that there's a real opportunity to get that intergenerational solidarity, because you're right, that's what's going to change things. And I think the human stories are so important, because that's what people connect with and people think about. Because it's a fundamental thing when you think about it. Like, I put out there that, you know, government policy over the last 10 years, everything has been about inflating house prices. Every single policy has been reinflating housing prices. And they assume that their Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil voter base of 50s and 60s and 70s are all in favor of that. And I think that's the big change that's needed.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing it if you look at the recent polls, and when it breaks it down into the age demographics. I do think that older generations are starting to change their mind and think, well, hold on, I don't want my kids living with me into their 40s and then my grandkids living with me in the house because they can't afford anywhere to live. Yeah. You know, they've served their time. I'm sure they're hoping in retirement they'd have the house to themselves.
Yeah.
But especially in Dublin, that's not going to be the case for a lot of people. They're going to have to live with unless things change, people are going to be living with their parents in well into their 30s, 40s and 50s.
Yeah. No, I see it myself. You know, I have four kids and, you know, it's like, I'm going, like, where are they going to get, you know, housing? And you know, and I got very choked up when I was on TV3 talking about immigration. And, you know, I was thinking about my own kids. But, you know, like I saw during the crisis of, you know, 2010 to 2015, so many of my, you know, contemporaries and, you know, people who were, you know, my age, you know, a bit younger, who emigrated, you know, and have never come back and just lost, like communities broken up. Like this is that human side of it, I think, hasn't really been talked about.
Yeah. And I was the same, like, and a lot of my friends are still living abroad from that 10 years ago. And yeah, I think you're dead right. Like it's once people see the human cost of this, and when the likes of yourself and myself and Killian Woods in the newspaper, it's like, when if we're making these policies a bit more understandable, like I'm not an expert on any of this stuff. I'm a teacher and I love being a teacher, but I'm not an academic on social policy. I'm not an academic on politics. I had zero interest in politics until I started trying to buy a house. So it's, I suppose, making it understandable for people, and especially the older generation who haven't really thought. They just vote, like they phone in their votes, like, you know, they're just kind of, yeah, we'll just vote for what I've always voted for. And
yeah,
hopefully there's a shift in that then when they realize, you know, this is going to be a huge issue for relatives, and it already is a huge issue. So
yeah,
hopefully things are starting to change. Well, I suppose we'll probably know a little bit now coming with the, I'm in Dublin Bay South, that's my constituency. So with that election coming up next month, it might be an insight into maybe how things are going to go.
Well, yeah, it is definitely going to be interesting to see. And there's no doubt housing is going to play a significant role, you know, in that. And the question, of course, will be, you know, how much are the government going to move? And I think that, again, the importance of highlighting and analysing this policy in a way that people can understand it is that there's so many sound bites, you know, thrown out. And, you know, they'll say, oh, you know, Taoiseach saying, or Taoiseach, former Taoiseach, current Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar saying, you know, in his speech to the Ardesh that, oh, I'm going, you know, we want to aim to build 40,000 houses. And people going, oh, they're going to build 40,000 houses. No, they're not. You know, they have no plan to build 40,000 houses. It's just figures thrown out, you know, and I think part of hopefully what we need to do is, you know, show that actually, you know, we need a proper plan to get, you know, affordable housing. But listen, there was a couple of things you wanted to talk about because you were banging on and you did a great piece of work highlighting what agents were looking for, the estate agents. And of course, they're, again, another, you know, one of these different interests who are, you know, very much, you know, keep the property market, you know, inflated. Rather, it's a big question of all the different interests involved, as you say, in the market, who are actually trying to rig the market to keep prices high and push them higher rather than actually make them affordable. What do you want to explain a little bit about what you did about there around that?
Yeah, it was Savills basically were looking for everything. They were looking for your bank statements, your savings account statements, proof of cash savings, proof of a gift. If you're getting a gift from a relative, they wanted everything, nearly like your diaries from your teenage years and everything they wanted to see. Just to drive up to the estate and have a look, just to view a house and see, is this somewhere I'd like to live? It was advertised as Luke, and I think it was more Clondalkin. I don't think the housing estate's actually in Luke, but anyway, so I just kind of posted about it saying this is outrageous for a viewing. And it kind of just went viral. And yeah, I had numerous journalists on. I tend to send a lot of stuff to a few of them anyway, when it comes in. But it went everywhere. And I to be honest, I had to turn down, I'd say, a dozen media requests because I just don't have it in me to go on TV and on radio shows, and I'm working full time.
It's hard, isn't it?
It's very hard. I had to turn it all down. Like, you know, I just I just wasn't able for it, but it worked anyway. You know, it got out there. It went everywhere. Even Darragh O'Brien was tweeting about it, and he agreed with me. And the Data Protection Commissioner then has just ruled yesterday, I think it was, saying, yeah, they can't be asking for this information. Now, I'm gonna defend the estate agents here a little bit, not Savills for viewings, because that's outrageous. But I know that estate agents had, at the beginning of COVID, were instructed, you know, you have to make sure that somebody has proof of funds when they're engaging in the house buying process. So agents took that and ran with it as, you know, I need to get see approval in principle. And any agent I dealt with over the last year and a half with doing viewings has been fine with my approval in principle letter with my figures redacted. Like, you don't want to show them your whole hand, especially if it's a house where you're bidding on it. Now, I know the Savills thing was all for new builds, but like, if you're engaging in a bidding process, you don't want them to see how much money you have, because they'll use every trick they can to get all that money out of you. So, and every agent I've dealt with has been fine. And for the most part, they were just doing what the PSRA told them to do. But then when this piece was published and it was in, I think it was in every newspaper, it was on RTE, it was on Persian Media, it was everywhere. And the PSRA came out and said, basically just threw all the agents under a bus and said, no, we never advised agents to do anything. We've always said follow data protection rules. So I do feel the PSRA were trying to wash their hands of it and put all the blame on the agents. But to be fair, I think they were just doing what they were told. Now,
and why what was the reason for it? Well,
their reasoning was COVID and not having as many people at viewings. And it all seems to go back to this notion that there are tire kickers out there looking to buy a house and spending their weekends going around viewing houses for the sake of it. And I mean, it's laughable. It's an absolutely horrific process. It's not one bit enjoyable. I wouldn't wish it on anyone. It's awful. You're going out looking at houses that are way, way overpriced, that are in bits, that need a massive amount of money at a time when renovation costs are at their highest in history. It's not enjoyable. People aren't getting their kicks going out looking at houses they can't afford. There are no tire kickers. So that argument is just, I just find it hilarious. Mm-hmm. Like, it's people that just haven't a clue, really. They're obviously not involved in the market at the moment, because there's nobody going around viewing houses for fun. It's awful. It's horrible. No one's enjoying it. I have not enjoyed 1 minute of it. It's been dreadful. So the tire kickers thing is just ridiculous. But I do agree that people should have to show they have approval if they're going to place an offer, because you don't want someone bidding up a house way over asking price and they have no mortgage approval. But to be honest, I think that's happening very, 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 very few cases of that. So I just think that argument's a bit silly, to be honest.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, a question about, you know, how house prices are rising. And obviously we don't have, you know, there is, you know, reduced supply and, you know, and obviously people have had, you know, savings over COVID and are going to buy now. So that's pushing up prices. And there's no doubt that, you know, the asking prices, and we're hearing it, asking prices have been pushed up all over the place by the sellers, by the agents, taking an opportunity of knowing, you know, that there's more, that they can do that, and people will feel pushed into it. What role do you think, or in terms of your own like anecdotal experience, investors or people who aren't buying the home to live in, maybe to rent it out or as an investment even for their family, or how much of that is going on?
I was looking at figures yesterday on the CSO, and that stated that I think 25% of all purchases now have been from investors. I don't know the figures, and it's very hard to tell if an investor is bidding. Like, you're relying on the agent to tell you if you're bidding against an investor or not. My fear and my worry, and I don't know whether it's just I'm just become so cynical from spending the last 2 years looking at, I'll just doom and gloom constantly when it comes to everything. I don't know whether it's just me being cynical, but like, it, from the messages I'm getting in, I think everyone's just assuming they're bidding against investors, because there's no way there can be that many people with this much cash that are willing to throw it all at incredibly overpriced houses. So to be honest, I don't know. The CSO reckon 25%. It could be a lot more than that, to be honest. And then that's not including the state as well and approved housing bodies. So I think that was another 13%. So to be honest, I'd say it's probably more.
Because someone contacted me recently pointing out that they were been told by someone who was working basically kind of when a house is bought, acting on behalf of like an agent, they would refit the house essentially. But they were told that they were working for, and this was in Clondalkin, an investor fund was buying up like second, you know, not new houses, you know, existing homes, and was going around buying up quite a few. And so, you know, people wouldn't be aware of this. And if you were going to buy that home, you would think you're bidding against other home buyers. But in fact, you're bidding against an investor. And I think it makes a farce of the government's response to the Maynooth housing estate development that, you know, they put in place measures which are, you know, not stopping investors at all.
Yeah, it's... Like the worry is that it's that kind of that BlackRock crowd, you know, that crowd over in America that is buying up all the secondhand houses. So another, it's buying your neighbor's house was the headline. That would be the worry, that it's them or a company like them. I get a lot of stories in from people in trades as well, saying that the Chinese have bought all of the insulation and everything that's driving all the prices up on all the materials. So I don't know, like it's probably happening a lot more than we think and more than the figures would state, the CSO ones. And I know they take a few months as well, but I don't know how much transparency there is there in terms of who's ultimately buying these things. It could be me, Carol McQueen, buying a house, but I'm being funded by an investment. I don't know, to be honest. And like I can go down the kind of conspiracy theories which I try avoid doing. But to be honest, I've really just stopped trying to make sense of it all because it gets quite overwhelming. And I feel like I'm spinning 100 plates, you know, trying to keep on top. There's a new scandal every day.
Yeah.
And I just, there's times, and I'm sure you feel the same, there's times where I'm just sitting there just going, oh, I'll just turn off my phone. Like I need to just bury my head in the sand here for a little while. I can't handle all this. Like it's just nonstop. And I guess it's how journalists feel when like political journalists or whatever, like, cause there's a new scandal in politics every week. I just feel like that's where housing is now as well. It's become just scandalous, I suppose, for want of a better word. So, you probably feel like that as well.
I do completely. Like you, as you say, like, you know, when you're getting, you know, messages, you know, all day, every day about, you know, people's situations, which you feel, you know, have an obligation to try and share them as much as possible, you know, get them out there. But you're like, even to share, you know, someone sends you a story and you need to try and put it together and screenshot it and put it together in a tweet. Like it takes 10, 15 minutes, do you know what I mean, to do that. And it's all time. And then, you know, as you say, something breaks and you have to try and read up on it and you have to try and be on top of it. So when, you know, if the media call, that, you know, you can give some sort of half decent response. And, you know, and the media is challenging as well, because you're often being a contrarian voice in a sense, you know, and there's that, you know, you're then been berated by some government politician, you know, and it's like that. Yeah, there's a lot of pressure. But I suppose what I feel is that, you know, we can only do what we can do, and you have to, you know, mind yourself as well. But it's really important work to be contributing. And if there was lots more people, you know, who were taking action on this, then, you know, it would be more sustainable. And I think there are, you know, there are lots of people, you know, like Uplift, like Catu, you know, the tenants, new tenants union, you know, there's action been taken, and more individuals are, you know, highlighting it. You can see it on social media. But it's very much needed. And on that, the what kind of do you see, or what do you feel in terms of your experience, you know, for you, what do you think needs to happen to make housing affordable?
The same thing I've said all the time from the beginning, because I see about 25 of them within my eye shot of my bedroom window nearly is vacant and derelict houses. Like in Portobello alone, there must be at least 100, if not more. There's that fabulous house beside the Bernard Shaw Museum. There's that gorgeous little cottage on the canal right beside me here. I don't know. No one's ever really given me a proper answer as to why it wouldn't work. So, and that's just taxing the empty homes. And I know there's the Fair Deal scheme that needs to be sorted out. And then, like, you know, if people have holiday homes or whatever, but like houses like that that are sitting lying derelict and vacant for as long as I can remember, as long as I've like been around here, like they must be here 20, 30 years, just sitting there rotting away. I just feel that's the low hanging fruit that like it's just so easy to pick and just start taxing them. I don't understand why it's not done. I know there is a vacant site levy, but it doesn't work. They don't even have the staff to collect the money. I think it was 1% of what was owed was collected. So
yeah.
That to me is the most obvious one.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think that the derelict properties and the derelict sites is a clear one. And you can see it. It's all over the city. It's all over towns, you know, small towns across the country. You know, the figures and the figures on, like, there's, you know, I think the figure from the CSO, I can't remember now, from 2016, it was maybe in the region of 150,000, might have been closer to 200,000, excuse me, homes were vacant. And that was homes, and that's not a derelict property. We don't have a register of derelict property, you know, and you can see it everywhere. And taxing is definitely one thing, but the other thing is the CPO, like local authorities aren't out CPOing them, you know, compulsory purchasing them, buying them up, you know, introducing use it or lose it laws. I think you're absolutely right. Dereliction is a massive issue. And Lorcan Sir actually gave the figure that there's, he said that above the shops, which isn't dereliction as such, but it's part of the vacancy thing, that there'll be 4,000 units could be got out of above the shop, just within the city centre, above the shop conversions that were actually usable. And now he was making the point they should be used for Airbnb and get the Airbnb out of, you know, homes, landlords renting them as actually, you know, permanent all year round Airbnb. But it's, you're absolutely right, the dereliction and people, even council properties been vacant. But it kind of comes back to the point that I've made, that the government, you know, there's loads of things they could be doing if they were actually serious about addressing the crisis.
Yeah, and that being the most obvious one, and then being able to borrow now at basically 0% and then be like, let the government be the developer. Do you know, like, and then they just hired the builders directly, or like that crowd that did the ones out in Fingal, the affordable housing out in Fingal.
Cool on.
Just do that on Nama land. Like, I don't know, is that too simplistic? I don't really understand the ins and outs of politics. I know it's obviously a lot more complicated than I know. And I'm sure, like any job, you know, when you go in, you realize, hold on, there's a lot more to this than I thought. But am I being too simplistic? I don't know. Like, it just seems too easy. But like, we can just look at what other countries have done well and look at the Vienna model and do the cost rental and just like do more of it. I know they've done maybe one scheme of it, but maybe like just do more. And as you said, compulsory purchase. If they're able to borrow really low rates or at 0% interest, and or do 100-year bonds or whatever. I know David McWilliams tends to have some good ideas as well on his podcast, whether some of them would work or not. I don't know, like, he knows more than I do. So I think yourself and lots of other people are given lots of solutions, and but they just don't really seem to be picking up on any of them.
Yeah, I think, like, in many ways, it is that simple, you know, but if I look at why haven't they done it, and it comes back to, you know, at different points over the last decade, they've had different excuses for why they couldn't do this. You know, initially it was all the country was bankrupt, and so they had to try and, you know, use NAMA to sell off all the loans, and the country didn't have any money to do anything. And then when, you know, the rents started rising in 2013 and 2014 and 2015, they were saying that they couldn't block the freeze the rents because it would stop investors coming in and building a supply. And then, you know, they were saying, oh, we're increasing our social housing budget. You know, we're doing it. We're increasing the spend. And, you know, it's just a marginal increase every year. No, nothing major. To me, it's like there's no real sense of urgency about it. It's like they're disconnected from the actual impact of the crisis, and they really don't want to. I think they are absolutely determined not to disturb what they call the market interests, the big market interests. And I think that's what it comes back to. And I was really struck by Fingal in selling that land to Glenveagh. They, I don't know if you saw that in Donabate, there's a plan to do 1,500 homes out there. And it was public council land, and they transferred it to the private developer, Glenveagh. And it's a 10-year plan to build 1,500 homes. It doesn't take 10 years to build 1,500 homes. You could build 1,500 homes in 3 years.
Mm.
And I just saw there was one line in the Irish Times which explained why it was going to be done over 10 years. And it was because they didn't want to have this 1,500 basically arrive on the market at one point.
Straight away, yeah.
Because it would lead to what? A fall in house prices.
Yeah.
And you go, it's actually all about structuring to keep the market inflated.
It's a chokehold then, isn't it? It's a chokehold on the supply. And that's what it comes down to, whether it's that not building quick enough purposely, apartments being left vacant to artificially keep rents high. Like, it all comes back to there just being a chokehold and too much control from private companies, and should just be the state taking over, going, look, no, we need to sort this. Do you know what I mean? We've too many people homeless. We're going to have a massive, massive issue, I think, when it comes to staffing the public sector. I think I'm seeing it already over the last couple of years with schools and finding teachers and finding subs and being able to fill a post, because people can't afford to live in Dublin. So if you're not from Dublin, chances are you're not going to want to live here because it's too expensive. It's not worth it. And then those that are from Dublin can't afford to live here, so they'll be moving out. And I do think we're going to struggle to staff schools. I think we're going to struggle to staff the new hospital when it's built. It's built right beside, that new hospital's right beside my school, actually. And where are these people going to live? They're not going to commute an hour and a half into work every day into James Street. It's not going to work. Where are they going to live? Like, you're looking at 350 grand for a tiny little cottage in Rialto there. So people aren't going to, can't afford it. They can't afford the rent around there. They're going to really struggle to staff it. I think we'll struggle to staff schools in the city and restaurants and supermarkets and all of those jobs that aren't paying 120 grand a year. And we're just going to end up like one of those horrible cities in America where you can't live there, unless, like San Francisco, unless you're earning 200 grand a year.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true that's where we're heading. So the question is, how do the people mobilize and express themselves and put on the pressure that actually gets the government to change?
I think the best thing people is, like, say somebody's listening to this now and they think, well, I've only 87 followers on Twitter or Instagram or whatever.
Yeah.
It's not about that. Like, and it's not like, I know my page, like the Instagram page, the Crazy House Project, it's doing really well at 45,000. So anything I post tends to like get a lot of hits. But the best thing anyone can do is talk to their family and talk to their relatives and say, look, I'm really struggling. I can't afford to live here. So all we can do is vote and talk to your relatives and say, look, this is the part. And I never tell anyone who to vote for, but talk to them and say, look, I've done my research. This party is going to help when it comes to housing. And we need a change. And unless, like, there is a change, chances are I'll have to move abroad and I'll have to emigrate. So I think what people can do is talk to their friends, talk to their relatives. And I suppose it's an Irish thing, you know, we don't really like to talk about money that much and talk about things that are of that much importance, you know, we tend to just kind of more have a laugh and stuff. But you probably just do need to have a serious conversation with the people around you and say, look, I need you to help me on this, and maybe vote a certain way and stop voting for parties that are contributing to the housing crisis. And because it's the biggest issue, that and health, they're the two biggest issues. So I think that would have a massive impact, I think, if people just spoke to those around them, especially older people, and even send them on that podcast that you did with Blind Boy. I just think he's a brilliant commentator on things. He's able to break it down into really understandable sentences and language, and just like kind of send that podcast on to people and just go, look, if you could listen to this, maybe we'll explain where we are. Rory explains all the issues really well. I think that's probably going to have the biggest impact.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right that it is in actually telling. It reminds me of, you know, the repeal and marriage equality and that sense of having those conversations across, you know, friends, you know, work colleagues, families, particularly within families, you know, saying, you know, that their experience and how that people saw it then and they listened. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, people need to talk to their families and friends and say, you know, this is not working for me. You know, I'm struggling and, you know, this needs to change. And we need major, major change on this. And we need to change how we see housing. As you know, I think the big change is the value shift, that, you know, this idea of it being an investment asset, you know, it's a home. People need bloody homes, not investment assets. And if we can really get that conversation, you know, happening in every house in this country, an apartment.
Yeah.
And, you know, that, and people say, you know, we want a big change. That I think the problem is, part of the problem is the election is potentially 4 years away or three and a half years away, but there is local elections, probably 3 years. But I think we need moments of mobilization before then, you know, whether it's a protest, a big massive national protest when we can, cultural events, musical events, you know, when they can happen, the online stuff that you're doing, I think the petition, those sort of things that show that there's a lot more people behind this.
Yeah. The protest thing gets brought up a lot. I get probably 10 messages a day asking me about organizing a protest. It's just, my answer is always the same. You know, I don't really want to put my name to one right now, because any protest over the last year and a half has been hijacked by extremists, anti-COVID, anti-vaccine, these type of people, you know, who I don't want anything to do with. And they tend to hijack these things and take over. And that would be my worry, being a teacher as well, and put my name to something like that would be, It's too iffy for me, to be honest. I'd rather it be a peaceful, kind of more organized, COVID-friendly thing down the line. But I think there's massive appetite there for a protest. I'm worried that the word protest has been kind of tarnished by those people, those extremists, you know. Like I was driving over to my folks one day, and I was driving around by Trinity, and I just saw a load of guards on bikes and a load of vans, and I just rolled down the window. I was like, what's going on? And he just kind of nodded down the road, and I looked down past Trinity towards Merrion Square, is it? Yeah. And there was just hundreds and hundreds of absolute head cases marching down the road towards me, like surrounding the car. No one was wearing a mask. Like, this was a couple of months ago. No one's wearing a mask and shouting. It was kids and in buggies and everything. And now, to be fair, they were fairly peaceful, very aggressive, but fairly peaceful. Like, they didn't smash the car up or anything, but just that kind of stuff. Just,
yeah, no, I think the context of holding a protest has to be right. Do you know what I mean? And the kind of that anti-masker thing that's still there right now, I think it's not the time right now. I think that there needs to be enough time that it won't be hijacked and that it will be completely safe. And I think it needs to be at a point where you can get 100,000 people on the street safely, and that's, you know, so I think it has to be at that point, yeah. Be that late of this year or early next year or something like that, or it's regional protests or something that allows massive numbers, because I think there's no point in having a protest of 5,000 or 10,000. It has to be 100,000 to show the impact. But I think that, so we're not there yet, and I would agree with you on that in terms of COVID and safety, but I think we need to find ways that can express that. So I think it is the online platforms, the, as I said, the Uplift petition is there, you know, your platform is there. We need to find ways, I think, you know, to highlight and get that conversation going. I think that's a good idea in terms of sharing the Blind Boy podcast as well. So there's lots people can do. And of course, people can email their TD at any point, email their local councillors, you know, and they feel that. They feel that pressure as well.
Yeah. Yeah. The email, I was, that was another thing I was going to do, was like organize an email campaign where, you know, I'd share kind of like a template email, because, you know, as much as people are angry, people also want the work done for them, and they won't take 5 minutes to type up an email themselves. They want a template. So, but the issue is then, one, they won't open the emails. They'll just go to spam. They'll set a spam filter up straight away when it has a certain subject. So people really need to make the email their own. Otherwise, yeah, it'll all go to spam. But yeah, then also, if people write an actual letter and post a letter, the letter has to be opened. So yeah, every TD has to open each letter. So that might be a better way. Mm. And people post a letter. Somebody got on to me about that. Somebody that worked for a TD said something like that to me, that, you know, if you post a letter, it actually legally they have to open the letter. Whereas with emails, you know, they can send them into spam. But I do think, you know, there's digital ways there, like you said, with, yeah, the petition, that things can be done.
Yeah. The other thing, of course, that's there is the referendum on the right to housing, that I think would be a very useful way to have this conversation as well about how we treat housing and how we view it. And I think that's, you know, a potential as well to really rally people around and get people around. Okay, here's something, you know, we want a major shift and we want to put a right to housing in our constitution.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah, and I think that's done in pretty much every other country, isn't it?
Well, there's lots of them anyway. Lots, yeah, of them. It's not every country.
Not every country in Europe, but yeah, a lot of countries other than us. But as long as I'm always aware. Like my page is so negative, and I'm not actually a negative person inherently. I'm usually quite positive, but it's very hard to be positive about housing in Ireland. It's so bad now. But I'm doing this thing on the page recently where I'm kind of sharing good news stories just to try and give people a little bit of hope and give myself a little bit of hope. And I do, whenever I post it, I've done it a couple of weeks now, and whenever I get hundreds of responses of good news stories, whether it's, and most of them are, you know, I've managed to go sale agreed at a good price, and a lot of stories of vendors selecting a normal person rather than an investor, which I think is fantastic. Because at the end of the day, when someone's selling a house, they're in charge of who they sell the house to, not the agent. So the vendor can say, look, I know this cash buyer or this builder or this investor offered 10 grand more, but I'm going to take 10 grand less and give it to this person who's local, who's from the area, who's, whether they want it to be a family home or if it's a single buyer, a single applicant or whatever. So I'm getting loads of those stories in where people have been the underbidder, but the person selling the house chose them. So that's really positive. That's lovely to hear. I'm getting a lot of stories of single parents being able to buy and getting approved or whatever and getting their house. So it's not all doom and gloom. Some people are getting lucky, and yeah, I'm not aware because I'm always moaning.
You're right. You're absolutely right. You know, it is important to highlight, you know, the good stories that are there, and, you know, that they're, you know, yeah, it isn't all doom and gloom, and there is hope, and, you know, this is possible. And I think as well, you know, examples like the Ocoolan Co-Housing Alliance, who are building actually affordable housing, and, you know, there is local authorities building some social housing, and, you know, I feel particularly for renters as well, who are, you know, really facing, you know, you know, insecurity, and there needs to be changes around that. And I think that, you know, when you look at, there are, you know, we can do this. We've done this before. This is possible. And I think you're right. It needs to be kept. You know, we need to keep that positive focus as well, and that hope, because we don't want another generation to bloody emigrate.
Exactly.
We want the generation rent to stay and live and make this the beautiful, wonderful country that it is and can be.
Yeah, and it's a massive cost to the taxpayer. Every one person that emigrates is a cost of millions to the taxpayer, because the money that has been invested into their education from the day they're born all the way up to university, and then they qualify, and then they just take all of that talent and just it's utilized in another country. Like, that's desperate. You know, we've worked so hard to get our education system to be free, well, supposedly free, but mostly free, and then all of that talent is just leaving the country like it did in 2011. It's horrible. So for every one person that leaves, that's a massive cost, both economically and socially for us. And like, I know rural Ireland was hit really bad the last time, so it's we just want to try and keep people here and stop them emigrating. Yeah,
because it does create the other idea, like I talk about in my book, about, you know, community-led housing, you know, like cooperatives, and, you know, there's a massive amount of public land there that, like, the state could, you know, support communities and, you know, people who want to, you know, build their own homes, you know, support them to build their own homes, build rental homes, you know, cooperatives. There's so much more that could be done. But listen, Ciarán, it was fantastic to have you on, and I'm delighted to chat to you on it. And I think we're going to change it. I think it's going to change.
Yeah, I've high hopes. Yeah, I'm very hopeful. I just, with the page growing as quickly as it is, and it's everywhere now. Housing is everywhere, and there is a huge appetite for change there. So yeah, I'm hopeful that things can change, and hopefully it doesn't take another massive recession and austerity to bring house prices down. Hopefully it can be as a result of good government policies. So yeah, I'm hopeful, and thanks for having me on, and thanks for all the work you're putting in as well. And I know myself, it's not easy. It's hundreds of messages a day, and it's emails, and trying to keep up with all this on top of working. So thanks. I get so many messages saying thanks every day. So I just, like, anytime anyone's thanking me, I'm always conscious to make sure, you know, you're not just thanking me. I get a lot of my information from you and from journalists and people that are really putting in massive amounts of work, and I kind of just collate it all and stick it up. So thanks for all your efforts and your hard work.
I know, I appreciate that, and thank you as well. It is really, you know, it's great to what you're doing in terms of highlighting, and as you say, connecting with people and you know, relating where they're at and giving them a platform. And because none of this is, you know, it's not inevitable that it'll change in a positive way. As you say, you know, we could end up going down that disastrous, like some US cities, you know, and as I call it in my book, the dystopia. But
yeah,
you know, when people take action and people stand up, then we can actually change it. So listen, Ciarán, great to talk to you.
Lovely, Rory. Thanks a million.
Thank you very much, Ciarán Mulqueen from Crazy House Prices. Check it out, Instagram, Twitter. And if you have your own story to share, you can send it to me. I can post it on Twitter or Instagram. It's at Rory Hearn. And we look forward to you as well being part of the Tortoise Shack platform. Support us if you can, to keep these fantastic episodes that you love so much going out. Go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Support us, see the difference. You get access to all the shows across the platform, including Reboot Republic first before they go out, and become a patron. I really appreciate it. And we look forward to talking to you all soon.